Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly radio program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman. This week on Bruderhof Radio...
You know, the primary perception out there is that we're 10 years beyond the fall of the Cold War, and while there have been reductions in the numbers of nuclear weapons from the tens of thousands down to the thousands, there is still no real intention to actually get rid of them.
For Americans living after the Cold War, the threat of nuclear holocaust is nothing like the daily reality it was 10 years ago. Following the breakup of the Soviet Union, our primary opponent in the nuclear arms race has seemingly disappeared, and America is now the sole master of the New World Order. But, unbeknownst to many Americans, the race for nuclear weaponry is still underway. According to proponents of nuclear disarmament, the United States military remains committed to the development of nuclear weapons technology, and it continues to explore new methods of delivering nuclear warheads, including the possibility of placing nuclear weapons in space. In addition, space-based missile defense systems, like that initiated by President Reagan in the 1980s, are once again garnering political support. And America's refusal to halt production of nuclear weapons may be contributing to a new arms race in Asia, as China, India, and Pakistan all engage in nuclear testing. In the wake of the recent month-long Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference at the United Nations in New York, Bruderhof Radio takes a critical look at today's nuclear arms race. We'll speak with Jackie Cabasso of Abolition 2000, a global network that demands immediate elimination of all nuclear weapons, and John Burroughs, the executive director of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy. We'll also hear from Carl Grossman, a professor at the State University of New York at Old Westbury, who has long been critical of U.S. plans for nuclear control of space and has written extensively on the topic. At the United Nations Non-Proliferation Conference, held from April 24th to May 19th, both nuclear and non-nuclear nations reviewed their commitment to the reduction of nuclear arms. This year, for the first time ever, attending nations agreed that their primary goal must be the complete elimination of nuclear weaponry worldwide. John Burroughs explains the significance of this decision.
The Non-Proliferation Treaty was established in 1970, and what it does is it prohibits the spread of nuclear weapons beyond the countries that had them at that time. And it also commits those countries that do have them, that's the United States, United Kingdom, France, China, and Russia, it commits those countries to pursue good faith negotiations on nuclear disarmament. Every 5 years, there's a conference held to review the operation of the treaty, and it tends to focus on whether the nuclear disarmament obligation has been complied with. But there are also issues that come up regarding, for example, whether Iraq or North Korea have violated the requirement that they not acquire nuclear weapons. So this year's review conference was just concluded at the United Nations in New York on May 20th. It was a four-week conference. At the conference, there was a coalition of countries. It's called the New Agenda Coalition. Well-regarded countries like Brazil, Sweden, New Zealand, Ireland, Mexico, Egypt, which were pressing the countries that have nuclear weapons to make good on their commitment to eliminate them. You know, the primary perception out there is that we're 10 years beyond the fall of the Cold War, and while there have been reductions in the numbers of nuclear weapons from the tens of thousands down to the thousands, there is still no real intention to actually get rid of them. So the New Agenda countries were pressing very, very hard to get some commitments from the nuclear weapon states to get the process of elimination underway. And they had some success. the point that they obtained that is most cited was an agreement to, quote, an unequivocal undertaking by the nuclear weapon states to accomplish the total elimination of their nuclear arsenals. This was the first time in the 30 years since the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, was established that the nuclear weapon states had been so clear about the requirement. They had often tended in the past to say, eventually we'll get rid of our nuclear weapons, or the ultimate goal of the NPT and of our efforts is to get rid of nuclear weapons. But this was a much more unambiguous statement.
While the Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference was hailed as a success by most nations, nuclear arms critics like John Burroughs and Jackie Cabasso remain unimpressed by the rhetoric. We asked Cabasso whether the United States is truly committed to the elimination of its nuclear arsenal.
Well, you've put your finger on exactly what the big question is now at the end of this Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference, because some very good language has been agreed to by the United States and the other nuclear weapons states. But for those of us who've made a close study of U.S. nuclear weapons policies and programs over the last decade, the rhetoric and the reality just don't match. And, for example, the United States, in all of its official policy documents, continues to rely on the threatened use of nuclear weapons as the cornerstone of its national security policy for the foreseeable future. And that has not changed. So the question is, what can be done to try to hold the U.S.'s feet to the fire to make its actions match its words? And that's really a tough challenge, especially given the current political climate in the United States. Yesterday, or the day before, I guess now, presidential candidate George Bush announced an equally contradictory position where he was advocating significant reductions in the numbers of nuclear weapons while also advocating deployment of a beefed-up so-called national missile defense system, which actually, by its very nature, is guaranteed to provoke Russia and China into refusing to cut and eliminate their nuclear weapons, and in fact could inspire a new arms race as they attempt to ensure themselves that they could overwhelm any prospective U.S. Defensive system. So we're in a very challenging time where we are now presented with two sets of contradictory realities.
Indeed, as Cabasso points out, the United States may be doing more to provoke a new arms race than it is doing to end the old one. Carl Grossman of the University at Old Westbury on Long Island says that the hypocrisy becomes readily apparent when we examine the continued drive to place nuclear weapons in space.
So here, while the U.S. has thankfully joined with other nations in saying, hey, eventually, I'd like to see a date set here, though, but eventually we must abolish nuclear weapons. This is sort of like what happened after World War One when they acknowledge that poison gas isn't something that wars could be fought with. It was a kind of an outer control, inhumane, not that war in any case is humane, instrument. The same is now being thought about nuclear weapons. And the U.S., and this is good, the U.S. is, I think, because of the efforts of groups like Abolition 2000, and the member organizations of Abolition 2000, the U.S. has, with some reluctance, been pushed to joining in an effort to get rid of nuclear arms. But meanwhile, the country is preparing to move into space and militarily, through its attainment of the, quote, ultimate high ground, unquote, space, lord over the planet below with weapons in space. And this has to be understood and has to be stopped. And I think it's going to take the world community. That's why it was a pleasure to be at the United Nations in recent weeks as part of the NPT process to alert folks to this this looming U.S. program. And I think it's going to take domestic effort. I think it's going to take work here at home.
J. John Burroughs says that in order to understand why the United States continues to push for nuclear space systems while presuming to support nuclear non-proliferation, we must examine the driving force behind the arms business, namely the military-industrial complex.
If you look at missile defense, it's a very hard thing to understand. The U.S. is ready to make a decision. The Clinton administration is ready to make a decision later this year about deploying a limited missile defense system. George W. Bush, a couple of days ago, said that as president, he would go forward with a more expanded missile defense system, including possibly space-based weapons. And sea-based, very expansive view of missile defense. Now, what is driving this? The actual threat to the United States in terms of missiles that can reach the U.S. is going down because the numbers are going down in Russia. North Korea and Iran are years, if not decades, away from having missiles. And why would they be crazy enough to threaten the United States with missiles like that anyway? So it's not clear at all where the drive for missile defense is coming from. And then you get to what is the role of the aerospace corporations in this, because they see just a bonanza ahead of them with missile defense, with space-based systems. In a way, a lot of the money-making that they had during the Cold War has been tapped out. They're not building missiles and planes the way they used to during the Cold War. Now they've got a new market. So I think that a lot of the drive towards missile defense can be attributed to the role of those companies.
But even in the face of a strong aerospace lobby and a military committed to nuclear power, those who oppose nuclear weapons are not disheartened. Abolition 2000, a network of anti-nuclear policy groups and grassroots organizations, believes that by connecting with other activist groups, particularly the growing anti-globalization movement, their message will be heard by the powers that be. Jackie Cabasso, a member of Abolition 2000, explains.
Yeah, well, let me mention in particular one very dynamic international movement which grew up very quickly since 1995, which is called the Abolition 2000 Global Network to Eliminate Nuclear Weapons, which has an 11-point statement calling as its central demand for the immediate commencement of negotiations on a treaty to eliminate nuclear weapons within a time-bound framework. That network has now grown to well over 2,000 organizations in more than 94 countries and has been very active in all of those countries and regions at the local level, at the national level, and internationally. And in fact, we think that we have had some effect on pushing the debate within the nonproliferation treaty context, because Abolition 2000 was actually born out of the frustration of these non-governmental organizations 5 years ago at the nonproliferation treaty conference. So there is a growing civil society movement, but the question is, will we be able to make the lateral connections with other issue constituencies, environmental and labor and anti-globalization movements? That's what really needs to happen in order to pull together a significant enough, a strong enough popular movement to really push on the government. We're trying to also show that nuclear weapons are kind of a structural element of the entire geopolitical situation right now, where the globe is very much dominated by one superpower, which continues to brandish these weapons, and that all the way through the nuclear fuel cycle, from the uranium mining to the production of fuel to the research, development, and testing and production of the weapons, there are victims. There are people who are dying from radiation exposure. The indigenous peoples of the world have been the front line of victims. They are people who have been exploited as uranium miners, whose land has been seized to create nuclear test sites and to house nuclear infrastructure. And so there's a whole network of indigenous people all over the world who have been directly affected by the whole nuclear enterprise and who actually are very active participants in this growing global anti-nuclear movement. But that's the kind of link that we still have to make more visible to the folks who are concerned primarily with human rights, with indigenous people's rights, and so on. The connections are there. They're everywhere we look, but it's our challenge is to really make them quite clear and viable for people.
And John Burroughs says that while the nuclear arms race may not be the galvanizing issue it was 20 years ago, strong popular opposition is still largely to be felt.
I actually think that there is a lot of sort of latent underlying awareness out there of the problem of nuclear weapons, but it's been pushed off the top of people's awareness because it isn't clear what to do about it. I think it's also the case that among, say, people in their 20s now, there's much more of a tendency to think of in terms of what can be done to support human rights, what can be done to get a clean environment. And one of the things that we are learning to do is to frame our message not so much in terms of we're facing the threat of nuclear holocaust, although I am sorry to inform you that even as we speak right now, we are facing the threat of nuclear holocaust, but not to emphasize that as much as nuclear weapons are just incompatible with the kind of world we want to create, in which we have a clean environment, in which human rights are respected.
In which democracy is the dominant paradigm, because nuclear weapons are fundamentally undemocratic also, as we've seen in the, not only in the way they're wielded, brandished in the international arena as a currency of power, but also in terms of the way in which the whole enterprise is operated outside the realm of public scrutiny in this country.
You're listening to a critique of the continuing nuclear arms race here on Bruderhof Radio. We'd like to hear from you if you've got questions or comments about this program. Give us a call toll-free at 1-800-778-8461. That's 1-800-778-8461. While a flurry of public outcry against nuclear weapons would seem to have an effect on the leaders of nuclear nations, the most effective way to end the nuclear era, says John Burroughs of the Lawyers' Committee on Nuclear Policy, would be to have one of these leaders publicly committed to ending the threat of nuclear war forever.
If we had some determined leadership from the very top of the American government, there are many things that could be done. If there was a president who said, "It is my top priority to get on with the process of nuclear disarmament," much could be done within a matter of days, weeks, and months. Let me give you the easiest to understand example of that. Right now, the United States and Russia between the two of them, have 5,000 nuclear missiles, submarine-based and land-based missiles, ready to fly within moments of an order to do so. So each side is still posed, just as it was during the Cold War, to devastate the other side within a half hour. This is an absurd situation, and yet the Clinton administration has permitted it to go on for the past 7 or 8 years. So if the president of the United States said, okay, it's time to start putting the nuclear age behind us, the United States could unilaterally, but through a series of reciprocal steps with Russia, drastically reduce the readiness of the nuclear forces on both sides.
Let me just add something to that, which is that characterization that I made a little earlier about U.S. national security policy is actually enshrined in a presidential decision directive. And that same policy extends to the NATO nuclear umbrella, which the United States maintains. The U.S. has about 150 nuclear weapons deployed in NATO countries. That policy was reaffirmed again in the Secretary of Defense's annual report to the Congress just this February, where he actually underscored a potentially expanded role for nuclear weapons in, quote-unquote, deterring the threat of chemical or biological or nuclear weapons. So while most Americans have no idea that nuclear weapons continue to play such a central role in U.S. national security policy, for example, and I like to use this example every time that I have a chance to speak. Right now, U.S. Trident submarines are patrolling the world's oceans at the same rate as at the height of the Cold War, ready to very quickly target and strike any place on Earth that they so desire. So most Americans have no idea that that's the situation, but every country in the world knows that essentially the threatened use of nuclear weapons backs up any U.S. military action or any U.S.-led military action.
And it is precisely because the United States is reluctant to give up its nuclear arsenal that we are faced once again with a threat of an arms race, this time between India and Pakistan.
You know, the United States led the world into the nuclear age. The first weapon was tested July 16, 1945, the Trinity test in New Mexico. Then the United States dropped two bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That was the beginning, and then other countries followed the U.S. Example, and it continues today. The Non-Proliferation Treaty was intended in some significant part to stop the spread of nuclear weapons from China, which tested in 1964, to India, and everybody knew at the time that the weapons would spread to Pakistan once they had spread to India. So the NPT was designed to stop that spread, but it failed. India tested in 1974, and then both India and Pakistan tested in 1998, and since then, perhaps even more significantly, have started to take steps towards command and control structures, deterrence doctrines, eventually deployment of nuclear-armed missiles. I had the chance to speak to somebody, Admiral Ramdas, who was chief of the naval staff for India in the early 1990s, and he said it was absolutely clear to him that if the U.S. had been showing that it was serious about arms reductions, and not even necessarily disarmament right away, just serious about arms reductions, that India would not have gone forward with its nuclear tests.
When India and Pakistan conducted their nuclear tests 2 years ago, one of the first things President Clinton said is, "I can't believe that South Asia is about to repeat the worst mistake of the 20th century." Now, if that isn't the most profoundly hypocritical statement, I don't know what is, except for the fact that when he was there recently, just about maybe 2 months ago, the day that he was speaking to the Indian Parliament, calling on them to sign the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the United States was conducting a so-called subcritical test at the Nevada test site. And this is a whole new program of underground testing, which doesn't produce a measurable nuclear yield, and therefore is, by the U.S., is not considered to be nuclear testing. So this incredible double standard continues to be perpetuated, and as John said, India and Pakistan are very much modeling their behavior now on the behavior of the U.S. and the Soviet Union during the Cold War.
Indeed, as the world moves into the 21st century with the United States as its only certifiable superpower, one would think it in our best national interest to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, particularly in space. Leading by example remains the best course of action, for if nations like India and Pakistan have followed us in arms buildup, they will almost certainly follow us in arms reduction. Carl Grossman explains.
What we should invest our time and our energy is in being a model to the world. I mean, if we're the unipolar superpower, if we're the last surviving superpower, we should be a model in terms of democracy. in terms of a peaceful coexistence. We shouldn't set ourselves up to be, as again this U.S. military slogan has it, to become the master of space. This is not right. I did a book in the 1980s on Nicaragua. It was called Nicaragua, America's New Vietnam. So I'm not unfamiliar with U.S. imperialism. But, I mean, this is way beyond the Monroe Doctrine. This is way beyond anything that the United States has done before. It's so beyond the pale. It's so extreme. And the world will not stand for it. And people will rise up. And you know, what is it going to get us?
We've seen at the international level some really extraordinary achievements. And in a way, I think what our task is in the United States is to take that same kind of energy and idealism and vision and now bring it to bear on U.S. Institutions, the U.S. Congress, the U.S. administration. In terms of what needs to be done right away, first of all, we have to stop missile defense. If missile defense goes forward, it's going to cause China almost certainly to increase its nuclear forces. That, in turn, is going to make it much more difficult to pursue multilateral negotiations that relate to nuclear disarmament. So we have to stop missile defense. We have to persuade the government that it's time to take the missiles off alert. It's time to stop this threat of instantaneous annihilation. And one good thing about Bush's statement a couple of days ago is that he endorsed that in some measure. He endorsed it, so it kind of opened up the space for debate. And we have to continue to get the message out and make people understand that nuclear weapons are fundamentally illegitimate, whether you look at it religiously, morally, legally, strategically, or in any way. They're fundamentally illegitimate, and the only true solution is to abolish them. And that message has been getting out to people over the last few years, and we've got to continue to get it out.
That's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio. Our guests today were Jackie Cabasso of Abolition 2000, John Burroughs of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, and Carl Grossman of the State University of New York at Old Westbury. For more information about the Abolition 2000 Global Network for Nuclear Disarmament, visit them on the web at www.abolition2000.org or call 805-965-3443. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman and Ben Wright. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount, in particular the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily, and in turn each member is provided for and cared for. For more information about the Bruderhof Communities and Bruderhof Radio, call 1-800-778-8461.